hardening, turning to cement. The room moved, flipping all around, and then she was down on her knees, her rifle on the floor in front of her, and one hand extended, holding her body up in a prone position. There was still no pain, but she could feel the weakness, the sensation of all her strength draining away. She waited for the final shots, the killing attack, but nothing happened. Her thoughts were jumbled, her mind fuzzy, confused. But she saw her rifle, and some last bit of discipline took charge. The soldiers would take her prisoner, drag her to some Sector 9 torture chamber. Unless they had to kill her. She gathered what remained of her strength and she lunged forward, her hands reaching for her rifle, even as the soldiers closest to her reacted, opening fire. A dozen or more shots hit her, and this time she did feel the pain, the burning agony of the projectiles tearing through her flesh. But her face held only a strange smile, born of the realization that her pain now would be brief, short-lived, and it would spare her torment beyond description. She felt the cool hardness of the floor under her, the warm wetness, the blood pooling all around. She slipped away, hoping as she did that her people followed her lead, that they embraced a merciful death, and not the hell that awaited those who were taken alive. Chapter 9. Restored Senatal, Troia City, Megara Oleus III, Year 322 AC. Tyler Baron walked through the soaring masonry arch, a polished marble edifice boasting to all who passed through of the power and glory of the Confederation, and even more so of the Senate that governed it. The effect was lost on Baron, though, and he only frowned as he stepped under it, trying to ignore the loud tap of his boots on the polished marble floor. All around, for kilometers in every direction, Troia City and the rest of Megara lay mostly in ruins. There was construction everywhere and in every city, every inhabited area on the planet, roads, hospitals, emergency housing, were all in desperate need of repair and rebuilding. It turned Baron's stomach to see that the politicians had poured such a vast amount of the still limited resources available to their own glorification, when so many millions still huddled together in vast tent cities, clustering around portable heaters and eating whatever, often inadequate supplies, reached them. Baron had long been troubled by the corruption and arrogance he saw in the Confederation's government classes, but the stark imagery of so much suffering so close to the opulence on display in the Senate compound was particularly upsetting. He carried images with him as he walked through the second of the series of restored great arches, views of his spacers and marines, of course, so many dead in the vicious fighting that had saved the Confederation, but others as well. Above them all, however, at that moment was the face of a young girl, no older than 5 or 6. He'd seen her wandering through the rubble, calling out piteously for her mother, who was nowhere to be found. He'd given the child all the coins he'd had with him, but even as he was reaching into his pockets, he cursed himself for the miserable inadequacy of the gesture. There was little food to buy and almost no medicine, and even as he'd walked toward the compound and the appearance he'd been commanded to make, he couldn't stop himself from calculating that little girl's chance of survival. A coin toss. Tyler Baron was a veteran, a stone-cold professional at the art of war, but he despised the losses and suffering so endemic to humanity's favorite pursuit. And as much as he'd long endured the pain of seeing his military comrades killed and maimed, he found the devastation and suffering of the people in general even more difficult to endure. Admiral Baron, welcome to the restored Senatal. My name is Allison Davies. Please call me Allison. Speaker Landry sent me to wait for you and to guide you to the meeting. The young woman was pleasant, almost irritatingly so, and she was dressed in the flawless attire of a senatorial aide. Baron tried not to frown as he glanced at the quasi-uniform, clearly brand new and quite expensive. But he felt his hands tightening, aching to form fists, as he wondered if there was any luxury, any pointless piece of self-aggrandizing nonsense the senators had failed to waste scarce resources upon. Thank you, Allison. I'm afraid I just got back to Troia City, and if I'm not too late, I suspect I am close to it. Baron managed something he hoped resembled a smile. Well, maybe hope was a strong word, given how little he gave a shit for senatorial pomp. Still, the young woman was not the target of his ire, at least not yet. She might one day rise to that level, but if she was a young politician in the making, if she'd been staring into her mirror every day for years, practicing giving speeches to cheering crowds, he had no proof. She deserved the benefit of the doubt, and Tyler Baron gave it to her. Emmett Flandry, however, was another matter. The Flandrys were rich, richer even than the Barons, if not quite as immensely wealthy as the Holsteins, and Emmet had skillfully used the confusion and tumult of the war and the forced relocations of the Senate to blaze a trail from the upper middle of the pack to the speakership itself. It had been an impressive move, even for a man with nearly limitless financial resources, and Baron knew he should respect the achievement, at least on some level. He didn't like Flandry, didn't respect the man any more than he did most corrupt politicians, and the politician's money-paved route to the top repelled him. Still, he hoped he might be able to work with the Senate's new leader. Like it or not, Emmet Flandry was one of the two or three most powerful politicians in the Confederation, and Baron, as the newly minted commander-in-chief of the Navy, was going to have to learn how to coexist with him. "Not at all, Admiral. The Speaker advised that you would be coming directly from the shuttle dock." A pause. "Congratulations on your marriage, Admiral. The entire Confederation rejoices with you." It was the same tone as before, flawlessly polite, with just enough seemingly genuine emotion to make the whole thing sound like staged bullshit. Baron felt his smile slipping away. The aide was pleasant enough, but he couldn't escape the growing certainty that her entire demeanor was utterly fake. Maybe she was closer than he thought to becoming the full-fledged political animal she clearly sought to be. "Thank you again. Now perhaps we should get to the meeting. I wouldn't want to hold things up." She nodded, and then she turned sharply. "Right this way, Admiral Baron." She walked across the vast expanse of the outer hall and down a corridor only slightly less ornate. Baron's head turned from one side to the other, and with every view of the opulence of the building, he became just a bit angrier. Finally, they reached a double door. The aide stepped inside and introduced him. "Admiral Tyler Baron, Commander-in-Chief of the Confederation Navy." She stepped to the side, and she stared at Baron with a sickly smile. The Admiral held back a sigh, and he walked into the room. "Speaker Flandry, Senators, I am sorry if I am late." "No worries, Admiral." Emmet Flandry had an unkempt look to him, uncommon for a politician of his current stature. He was clad in an immensely expensive suit, but it was so rumpled he looked as though he'd just rolled out of bed. He spoke with an almost insane Falafelian drawl, which surprised Baron every time he heard it. The disheveled old politician had been back to his dreary homeworld in 2 decades at least. His political machine was so all-powerful, so dominant on that relatively poor and backwards planet, he never had to trouble himself to return home to campaign, or to meet any of his constituents. They were little more than votes to him, and ones he didn't have to work too hard to gather. "It is a great honor to have the hero of the Confederation here with us." The words were gracious and respectful, but there was something about the tone and the delivery that made it all sound dirty to Baron. "Of course, Speaker Flandry." Baron turned toward a woman standing along the opposite wall. "Ambassador Carmicia." He nodded his greeting. He'd been practicing his manners around hegemony personnel, but the scars of war were slow to heal. Part of him wanted to pull his pistol from its holster and turn the hegemony's ambassador into a stain on the shining marble of the wall. "Admiral Baron, I am quite pleased to see you here. I have much to discuss with this committee, and I believe you will understand most of it quite clearly." She hesitated just for a few seconds, but something about the edginess in her mannerism struck Baron. He had come prepared to ignore or disbelieve anything Carmicia said, but as his eyes focused on her face, on the rigid tension in her shoulders, realization slowly dawned. She is scared. Carmicia continued, maintaining her composure, but unable to completely hide the fear Baron suddenly believed was very real. "I'm here to speak of an enemy we call the Others, an adversary who is not only deadly dangerous to the hegemony, but also a dire threat to the Rim and all humanity wherever it exists." It was an almost wild claim, a lie so daring, so exaggerated it wouldn't fool a child. There was only one problem, and it weighed on Baron like chains. He didn't think it was a lie. He prided himself on reading people, which most of the time meant disbelieving what he was told. But now his eyes were fixed, and his attention was on the hegemony master, even as pieces began to assemble in his mind, most prominently the explanation Carmicia's claim offered for the hegemony's sudden abandonment of their invasion, and perhaps even more for their stunning surrender of Colossus. "That is quite a claim, Ambassador. In the bayous of Philophoria, we've got a saying. When somebody tells you they ran into a swamp lizard, cut the size in half." Baron's eyes shifted to the politician. His first thought was to deride the man, to wonder how he could miss what he himself perceived so clearly as sincerity in Carmicia's statement. But then he realized, he does believe her, or at least he suspects there is truth to what she says. He's working her, trying to see how she reacts. He stared at Flandry, and his read on the politician changed. The speaker still disgusted him in many ways, but there was a new respect growing. Or at least something like respect. Don't underestimate this man. Speaker Flandry, I assure you I am telling nothing but the truth. Our recent withdrawal from the Rim is a testament to the danger. The hegemony has never failed to absorb a human population, never in its history before the cessation of the recent war. It was the appearance of the others that prompted our actions, and whatever differences and bad feelings remain between our peoples, I can assure you most earnestly that the others are a deadly threat not only to my nation but to yours. If we of the hegemony are defeated, the Rim will fall in its turn. I have come to warn you of this threat, and I have brought evidence with me. I urge you all to review it, to understand the magnitude of the threat, and when you have, my government has instructed me to— Garmisha paused, and for the first time she seemed visibly uncomfortable. They have instructed me to request a treaty with the Confederation and with its allies. Another pause. I am here to ask for an alliance, for the Rim powers to stand with us against the others, to contribute your armed forces to the fight against the others. The room was silent. Even Speaker Flandry apparently lost for words. Baron looked around the room, struggling at first to get a read on the senators present. Then slowly he began to see their doubts, even anger. Garmisha's words hadn't swayed them. But they had convinced him. He was still trying to fight it off, to argue with himself, but deep down he believed she was telling the truth, that there was a deadly threat out there. And he suddenly realized he'd been concerned about something of the sort for months, ever since the war's sudden end. Baron feared the idea of a deadly new enemy, of leading his exhausted and depleted warriors into a new fight, a deadlier fight. But perhaps most of all he dreaded having to stand beside the enemy that had hurt his people so badly. He wasn't proud of his hatred, but he also knew it had helped him deal with the losses, the pain. He wasn't sure he could let it go. He wasn't sure he could survive without it. By all means, Ambassador, you have been granted an audience with the Senate's Leadership Committee. Show us your evidence, but I warn you, whatever you have brought will have to be compelling to overcome my doubts, and I suspect those of my colleagues as well. Baron watched as Flandry spoke, and for all the speaker's evident skepticism, he became more certain with each passing second that the politician was at least concerned. He'd been standing since he'd arrived, but he sat down as Carmisha proceeded to lay out the supporting evidence she'd brought with her. By the time she was finished, Baron felt fear, worry, foreboding. But one thought rose above them all, one realization he found most daunting. How am I going to tell my spacers and marines they have to fight another war, as allies of the hegemony? I'm going to be blunt, Admiral. I know you don't like me. You don't like any politicians. That's okay. I don't much like most of the officers who prance around with chests full of medals, feeling superior to the rest of us, as if fighting a few battles is all it takes to run the Confederation. So let's make an agreement just between us. We'll both cut the carnosaurid crap. I like to think I can smell a load from a kilometer away, and my read on you is that you can too. Baron didn't like the politician, but his quasi-respect for the man's intellect was growing. He'd been surprised when the speaker had requested, not ordered, that Baron come to a private meeting. The whole thing felt a little like climbing into some kind of mud pit, but he needed to find out just what the speaker thought of Carmisha's request, and he figured there was at least a chance of honesty and straight talk if no one else was around. And that sounded like straight talk to me. Baron couldn't remember the last time someone had begun a conversation with a declaration of mutual dislike. He found it strangely refreshing. Flandry was still vermin. His thoughts on that hadn't changed. But he was smart vermin. And just maybe, that made him useful as well. I like to think I have a reasonable nose for it, Speaker, though I've never seen a carnosaurid, I'm afraid. We don't have anything like that where I'm from. Just some good-sized birds of prey, wingspans of 3, 3.5 meters. Baron almost continued, but he decided to let Flandry take the lead. I'm certain of that, Admiral. Your nose, I mean. As to the matchup of a flock of giant birds against a carnosaurid, we'll just have to leave that with a big question mark on it. Flandry paused and a crooked line appeared on his face, something quasi-disturbing that Baron guessed was a smile. So let's do each other a favor. I won't congratulate you on your wedding, and you don't tell me how wonderful you think it is that I gain the speakership. Neither one of us cares, but I do think we both care about keeping the Confederation safe. Whether that comes from some high principle of patriotism or simply a realization of vulnerability emphasized by the debris spread across Megara and the other costs of the last war is irrelevant. We have been forced to stare into the face of our exposure, and I feel confident that neither of us wants to see Megara occupied once again by an enemy. Any enemy. Baron listened quietly, and then he nodded. I believe we can agree on that, Speaker. We have too often allowed confidence to turn into pride, even hubris. And we paid a terrible price for it. I, for one, do not feel we can ignore any threat, proven or not. The White Fleet was a noble effort. Baron paused. It had been noble to his view, but he hadn't been oblivious to the fact that it had also been a way for the Senate to get rid of a military officer who'd become a bit too popular. Then we are agreed. Despite the committee's rejection of Ambassador Carmisha's request, I do not think we can simply ignore this potential danger. And yet neither do I believe we can simply join forces with the hegemony. For one, what guarantees do we have that they will not simply continue their attempt to conquer the Rim after we help them defeat their enemy? Baron was surprised at Flandry's words. They went against much of what he'd come to expect from politicians and their short-sightedness. You are realizing I'm not the same kind of political animal you've dealt with before, Admiral. Oh, by all means, let's continue our agreement not to dance around each other. I'm as much of a politician as any you've ever met, but I'm a practical man as well, born on a bayou rice plantation that made enough in a good year to feed us all and maybe fix a leak in the roof. I don't believe my own bullshit, at least not entirely. I know you blame past Senates for the lack of preparedness for the Union Wars, and I can't argue with you about that. You're right. It's understandable enough. Senators from places like Yulion or Creighton have their hands full often enough just maintaining their grip, but they're generally for more military spending to keep their factories running. But it takes a lot more to grease the population of a core world like Yulion than a few big orders for guns or ships. At least it did before the Hegemony War. Fortunately for me, Philophoria is a putrid, blood-fly-infested pit whose people don't have the vision to see much beyond a Confederation-funded flood control project or two. It's cheap and easy to maintain, my base, Admiral, and I don't need to raid military budgets to fund a lot of crowd-pleasing foolishness. You may look at me and see a corrupt politician, but I'm also one free enough from the need to buy my next re-election to actually try to decide what's best for the Confederation. Baron listened to every word with growing surprise. He'd never heard a politician speak quite so honestly. He found it refreshing, but also unnerving. I appreciate your candor, Speaker. It is quite unexpected. It's not something you're likely to hear outside the walls of this office, Admiral, but I think we understand each other. You're an idealist in some ways, or at least enough of one that I don't think you harbor images of making yourself a dictator or emperor. You've had chances before, one I suspect I might have taken myself. So if I don't have to worry about you as a rival power, not too much at least, then I can work with you and take advantage of your unquestioned military skills. The room was silent for perhaps half a minute. Baron was trying to wrap his mind around what he was hearing, and Flandry was giving him the time he needed. Finally, the speaker spoke again. So, Admiral, assuming your silence signifies some type of tentative agreement, perhaps we can discuss a course of action. Simply put, straight from the swamp as we put it back home, what should we do next? Chapter 10 All of the People Liberté City Planet Montmorel, Gassara 4 Union Year 225, 321 AC There was no way to deny it, no time for pointless hopes or prayers for a miracle. The coup had failed, and it had failed badly. Gaston Villeneuve was a sociopath, a man utterly without conscience, without regret for any of his actions, however vicious and violent. But he wasn't a fool. Quite the contrary, he was a genius in his own right, a brilliant if twisted intellect. Kurevsky suddenly knew, the realization hitting him like the first shaft of dawnlight. It was over. Any chance of overturning the Union's government, of whatever faint and fragile hopes he'd had that Sandrine Ciara might prove to be a less despotic leader, or at least one less hostile to the Confederation, were gone. All he could do now was try to mitigate the damage. He'd covered his own tracks fairly well, at least he thought he had. But suddenly he was plagued with doubts. Was he underestimating Villeneuve again? He turned and snapped off a series of orders to his aide. He had to assume the worst, and that meant staying in the shadows, at least until he had a better sense of what was happening. He considered himself tough, and he'd seen his share of pain. But he was also experienced enough to dispense with false confidence. If Sector 9 came for him, if Villeneuve was prepared to risk provoking the Confederation by torturing its ambassador, he was certain he would tell them everything he knew. Not quickly, perhaps. He still liked to think he could maintain his defiance for a good while. But Sector 9 was expert at breaking people, and they would eventually wear him down. No, you can't let them take you. He would kill himself before he let that happen, but he wasn't one to give up easily, and he had another alternative. He could lay low, even hide if he had to. His first thought was to get to his ship, but that was pointless. If Villeneuve was prepared to throw the Confederation's ambassador into a torture cell, he'd be ready to open up Montmorel's defensive batteries and blast one lone Confed cruiser to dust. There were other options, preparations no normal ambassador would have made. Kurevsky was a spy himself, and the foot in that camp had always been more securely planted than the one in the diplomatic world. He had safe houses, stashes of currency and weapons, all sorts of resources in place for just the eventuality he faced. Sector 9 could find all of those too, of course, if they looked hard enough. But not immediately. And with the failure of the coup, all he could do was play for time. Destroy the records, Kyle, and get the staff ready. We're going to activate one of the safe houses, now, just in case. Yes, Ambassador. Kyle Corbin had always looked even more uncomfortable in his role as a diplomat's assistant than Kurevsky had been an ambassador. Corbin was a spy, too, and a damned good one. Kurevsky paused. Sandrine and Ciara pushing her way into his thoughts. Doctrine was clear regarding the handling of burned assets, but he was having trouble writing her off so quickly. If she was even still alive somewhere. He told himself they'd been using each other, that they'd become lovers for practical reasons, to work each other the best they could, and not out of any emotional nonsense. Sex had always been a prominent part of an espionage toolkit, and the fact that each of them had been employing the same tactic on the other didn't change the basic facts. But the thought of her in a Sector 9 cell, screaming in agony until her throat and vocal cords were reduced to bloody ruin, troubled him. He cursed himself, berated his lack of discipline, his weakness in allowing himself to care what happened to someone he should just have been using. Worse, perhaps Ciara had failed, and her value and utility had plummeted along with the prospects of her coup. She was a liability, even if he could find her. Trying to save her would be exceedingly dangerous, and even if he pulled it off, having the prime perpetrator of the coup remain at large would only inflame Villeneuve's paranoia and eliminate any chance of things blowing over. But then he saw her face again, smiling, lying next to him at first, but then morphing into a screaming, tormented nightmare. "Get everything ready. I'll be right back." It was stupid, insane, and every bit of his training and experience cried out to stop him. But it all failed. Sense, tradecraft, the cold, analytical way he normally approached problems. He just couldn't leave her, not to the fate Villeneuve would inflict on her, and he knew she'd never escape on her own. Not without his help. He put up his hand, stifling Corbin's objection. "I know, Kyle, I know. Just do what I asked." He exchanged a quick glance with his aide, and then he slipped out the door, heading toward the door, and into the wild tumult of a dying coup and a city gripped in its deadly aftermath. Sandrine and Ciara raced down the street. It was more of an alley, really, lightly traveled and out of the way. If anyone spotted her there, they'd be suspicious at once, but at least she had a chance to avoid contact. If she ventured out onto one of the main avenues, she expected her lifespan would be measured in minutes. Her image was everywhere, and she hadn't had the time or place to even make an effort at a disguise.
"No, they won't kill you. Villeneuve wants you alive. He wants to show you what happens to those who betray him."
She felt a chill, and her body shook uncontrollably. She was operating on adrenaline, her intellect and cunning subverted almost entirely to an animalistic desperation to survive. There was no place for critical thought, for detailed analysis. Such pursuits could only verify the hopelessness threatening to overtake her. Even as she ran, as her instincts led her, random thoughts drifted through her mind. It was strange, she mused, that she should feel such terror. She'd killed her share of people, even sent many to the very torturers that awaited her. It seemed that one who had done such things, committed such cruel acts, should be ready to face their own fate with at least some sort of composure. But she was as coldly terrified as her victims had ever been, as much consumed by mindless panic as any target she had killed or tortured. It was worse, perhaps. She had a much clearer idea of what awaited her than most of Sector 9's victims. She turned a corner, her already knotted guts tightening further, until her eyes confirmed the alley ahead of her was still clear. She sucked in a deep breath, struggling to hold back the contents of her tortured stomach, and failing as she leaned forward and retched up a small bit of foam and bile. She knew she should keep going, that there was no time for rest, but she could feel her resolve fading, and even as her will to live flared up, screaming from inside for her to keep running, another realization formed.
It's over. There's no way out, and you can't let them capture you.
There'd been a certain kind of courage in launching her coup, but she began to sense that much of it had been delusion, false confidence of success, fending off the terror of the consequences of defeat. Now she faced a grim conclusion. She had to kill herself. There were no other options. She'd taken lives before, many of them, yet the thought of killing herself, of plunging her knife into her own chest, seemed impossible. She knew she'd endure an end 1,000 times slower and more painful if she didn't, but as she faced the reality, it seemed an impossible thing to do.
You have to. You know what the alternative is.
Her mind was dark, filled with shadows, the distorted faces of people she'd killed, laughing at her, tormenting her, as she faced the same black fate she'd inflicted on them. They were spies, traitors, she told herself. They deserved death. But she knew that was only partially true. She'd killed innocents, too, and no small number of them. Guilt and innocence were largely irrelevant concepts in the Union, and suspicion alone was enough to mandate a death sentence. But she had gone beyond even such casual brutality. She'd tortured and killed people to influence others, murdered husbands, wives, children of those who resisted her demands. She'd never considered herself evil. She'd simply done what was necessary to preserve the Union and to advance her own position. But now that she faced the same end she'd inflicted on so many others, she felt as though she was torn in two. Part of her wanted to survive, to find some way to escape. But there was a voice in the depths of her mind growing in intensity, a dark shout that she deserved death and torture, that her current situation was nothing more than simple justice. Would there be redemption in enduring what she'd inflicted on so many others? She didn't have the answer, but whatever it was, she knew with grim certainty she didn't have the courage. She pulled out the knife, the last weapon she had, and she held it in front of her. She paused, wondering with almost absurd detail how to do it. Should she plunge it into her chest, or cut her own throat? What would be the quickest, the least painful? For an instant her fear ebbed as the analysis became almost clinical, removed from her in some way. Then reality reasserted its dominance. She held the knife in front of her, the razor-sharp point pressing against her clothing. She increased the pressure, feeling resistance from her jacket. Her arms loosened and she pulled the knife away, her other hand moving about the jacket, slipping the garment off. Then she pulled at her shirt, tugging at the material, exposing the flesh below. She pressed the knife against her again and she recoiled at the coolness of the blade on her skin.
Do it. Do it now.
Her thoughts battled inside her, waging a war in her head, her rational mind pushing her to finish things, to escape the terrible torment that awaited her. But the fear pressed back, the will to live struggling to hold her hand, to keep the blade back, to live, even if only for a few more minutes.
There's no other way. You know what will happen if they catch you.
She could feel her teeth grinding, her body racked by chills, even as the sweat poured down her back in torrents. Pain, too, as a fleeting bit of courage gave her the strength to push hard enough on the blade to draw blood. But she couldn't finish, couldn't bring herself to make that last push. She felt stark panic at what would happen to her if she was captured, but she couldn't kill herself, at least not with only a simple blade. She had to do something, find a way to escape. She didn't know how that was possible or who could help her, but she had to try. Who would even help her? Whatever allies she had were either dead or in Sector 9's cells, or they were doing everything possible to distance themselves from her and her planned coup. She had used people her entire life, done terrible things to gain power and position. She had no friends, no real relationships. No one would help her when she had nothing to offer in return. She stood for a moment, her mind grasping for something, anything. Then a single thought materialized.
No. Why would he help you? You used him, just as you have everyone else.
Alexander Karevsky had been an asset, certainly, But as she stood there fighting off the panic, trying to take control, she realized there had been something more there.
But you used him anyway. Why would he care? Why would he risk himself to save you?
She was shaking her head, trying to push the idea away. Kurevsky was just one more acquaintance she'd mistreated, a tool that had served a purpose. But he was something more. There had been a connection there. She had felt it, and she suspected he had too. It was tenuous, a sparse and frayed hope that the Confederation ambassador could help her. But there was no point in deeper analysis of whether Kurevsky would help. He was her only option. And through her fear, the blind panic gradually turning her intellect to pure instinct, she realized the alley where she stood led to the Confederation embassy or close to it.
This is stupid. He won't help you. And even if he wanted to, what could he do?
It didn't make sense. It was pointless. She tried again to bring the knife to her chest, to gather the strength for one final thrust. But it just wasn't there. Kurevsky was all she had, assuming she could even get to him. Chapter 11. Planet Calphron, Sigma Nordlin 4. Year of Renewal 267, 322 AC.
I am relieved beyond words to see you, old friend. Kronos stepped forward and embraced Ilias.
It was an oddly expressive gesture, and far more emotional than Number 8's usual demeanor. But Ilias understood. There would be a certain amount of delusion among the members of the Council and the Hegemony's senior masters, calls for his head, accusations that his incompetence, and not some overpowering enemy, had been the cause of the disaster at Venta Draconis. But Kronos knew and trusted him. His friend was a longtime skeptic of the legends of the others, as he himself had been. But Kronos was nothing if not a realist. With over 100 ships lost, and Ilias's own admission that his fleet had not destroyed a single enemy vessel, there were no other conclusions to reach. None based on analysis and not on unfocused arrogance and pride. The Hegemony had met its match, and possibly its doom. Ilias knew that, and he'd spent the trip back to Calphron trying to find a way to meet the threat and to overcome whatever dithering overtook the Council. He'd been confident on one thing, at least, that Kronos would be rational.
It is good to see you, Number 8.
Ilias knew Kronos well enough to call the Master by his name. The use of his ranking title was a desperate reminder to himself of his friend's rank and power, and whatever meager hopes he could draw from that.
I came right back here to report, though no doubt word has already reached the Council, if not the general public.
The Council, yes, but not beyond. The vote to impose secrecy was unanimous.
Ilias could tell from Kronos's tone. His friend didn't approve of withholding such news. Whether he'd voted with the others out of political maneuvering, there was no gain in being the sole vote against, or because, as much as he disliked the classification of such important information, he still believed it was the best option, was still uncertain. Kronos was generally straightforward and direct, but Ilias knew his comrade was not above playing the game when he had to. The two men were silent for a few seconds. Then Ilias reached out and put his hand on his friend's arm.
Kronos, my report is not all doom and despair.
That was only partially true. His report and his own outlook were pretty damned close to hopeless. There was a scrap of good news, and that was better than nothing.
We were unable to track the enemy with sufficient accuracy to establish target locks, all except for one ship, a cruiser. Captain Tragus, the commander of Avia, insists his ship was able to establish a usable lock, and that they scored a hit on one of the enemy vessels. I questioned the report at first, but there is substantial evidence to support his claim. Scanner reports from Avia and from other vessels positioned nearby back up Kilaron Tragus's claims. It appears Avia did score a hit on one of the enemy vessels.
Kronos looked back for a moment, a thoughtful expression on his face. Then he said,
That is certainly worth looking into, but can we be sure Kilaron Tragus developed some way to target the enemy? Perhaps it was a fluke, a lucky shot, or even something that exploited an enemy malfunction or mistake. It must be repeatable to be of use.
I thought the same thing, Kronos, until I reviewed the data. I am convinced Kilaron Tragus found a way to track the enemy's ships, with sufficient accuracy to support dynamic targeting. I have reviewed his theory and methodology, and I believe it offers us hope of being able to adapt to meet the enemy next time with at least the ability to inflict damage on them. We may not have the accuracy we'd like, and our weapons are certainly less powerful than theirs, but I believe Tragus' scanning protocols will work. We're still outmatched, perhaps hopelessly so, but at least next time we might be able to do some damage to them.
Kronos looked back, silent for half a minute, with an expression that made it clear he would have disbelieved utterly what he'd just been told had it come from someone less reliable than Ilios. Finally, the Master said in a tone that combined equal amounts of hope and skepticism,
"Well, then the first order of business is to sit down with Killer Tragus and have a hard look at what he's come up with."
He paused again, looking around.
"And we will keep this to ourselves for now, Ilios. The Council has descended into politics and infighting, no doubt powered mostly by fear. I will assemble my own research team to review Tragus' data. That way we can be sure nothing interferes. And for the moment, I think fear's our ally, at least in keeping the Council in line. Let us not offer unsubstantiated hope just yet."
Aegea read the words from the screen, her voice a bit wobbly, perhaps, but executing the entire effort with a skill that belied her tender age. The little girl had long wisps of hair hanging down to her shoulders, the color a cross between blonde and light brown that defied simple categorization. She was also perfect, at least to Kronos's biased eyes.
"Very good, Aegea, my sweet."
Kronos knelt down and put his hands on the girl's shoulders. He looked back toward the only other person in the room.
"She is amazing, Akella."
Kronos knew it was unseemly for one of his rank to be so taken by a mere child, even his own. But Aegea had quickly gained a hold on her father, and she hadn't let go.
"She is quite the terror, too, I can assure you of that."
Akella smiled as her eyes moved back to the girl. Her half-brother was nowhere close to the handful she is.
"That is a sign of extreme intelligence, you know."
Kronos was the eighth most genetically perfect human being known to the hegemony, and he was fully aware how absurd his dotage was. He just didn't care.
"Is it now?"
Akella smiled at Kronos, half the warmth due a longtime friend, and half looking very much like something else. Hegemony culture did not promote or even allow permanent relationships, and certainly nothing like the paired couplings prevalent in the Confederation and some of the other Rim nations, and certainly not among the Master class. The hegemony existed to pull humanity away from the abyss, and monogamy, particularly among those possessing the strongest genetics, was an impediment to advancing the foundational quality of the human stock. A Master was expected to have multiple children, ideally each with a different partner. Kronos believed fully in that policy, in theory at least, but in his moments of true clarity, he realized he had also allowed his affection for Akella to grow into something inconvenient in hegemony society.
And the look he'd caught in her face told him she felt at least somewhat the same.
Akella turned and gestured toward a woman standing in the doorway.
"It is time for Aegea's nap, Cassis." "Yes, number one."
The governess walked across the room and reached out to take the child's hand. Aegea objected immediately, and she lunged quickly to escape and run toward Kronos. The Master smiled again, and on a deeply hidden level, the child's iron grip on him tightened.
"Go, my sweet. It is time for your nap. I will come to see you again before I leave."
Kronos always found it difficult to leave the girl, but hegemony culture and law was adamant that children lived with a genetically superior parent. His other offspring lived with him, as befitted number 8 of the hegemony. But Akella's ranking exceeded even his own lofty designation. Aegea's mother was nothing less than the most genetically perfect human being known. She was also the hegemony's effective ruler, though she shared power with the other members of the council. Despite her rank and her immense roster of responsibilities, she found considerable time to spend with both of her children, something else that set her apart from many of her peers, and fed Kronos's ever-growing feelings for her. The two stood quietly while the governess carried the girl out of the room. Then Akella spoke, the happiness so recently evident in her voice gone.
"Your message mentioned something hopeful, some new tactic. Anything other than despair would be most welcome right now."
Akella had seemed cheerful when Aegea was in the room, but now Kronos got a serious look at just how heavily the stress and tension had worn on her. The council was largely full of narcissists who delighted in every bit of power and privilege they could gather to themselves. But Akella had always been different. She'd accepted the responsibilities and workload her genetics had destined her to endure, but she'd always seemed like she longed for a quiet and simple existence, something Kronos knew she realized she could never have.
"None of us will have anything if we don't find a way to win this fight."
His mind's discipline failed for an instant, and an image of Akella and Aegea flashed through. Not smiling and happy as they'd been moments before, but dead and bloody, lying under the ruins of Calphuron. No, I won't let that happen, whatever I have to do. But Kronos knew the words were empty, even as they came out of the depths of his mind. I have begun researching Killer Ontragus's data. Avia's entire crew has been transferred to the project and sequestered. A pause. I thought this was best kept quiet, at least at first. By quiet, he meant hidden from the council and the meddling of the other senior masters, and he had no doubt Akella understood him perfectly. He was less sure, though, that she'd support something that would only cause more problems if it was discovered. She frowned for a few seconds, but then her face resumed its neutral expression. It will be unpleasant if word leaks out or even when we finally have to report the findings, but I agree with your decision. The council is simply too divided, and this is life or death. That was what I thought. I am sorry I didn't tell you sooner. I wasn't sure. You weren't sure I would agree with you. No. Well, not entirely. But I didn't think you needed more bearing down on you. So why tell me now? You could have hidden it a bit longer. Because we've made some progress. We believe we have verified Tragus's tracking method. Tell me about it. But remember, it has been some time since my days in the lab. Kronos pushed aside a passing thought, a concern about hegemony society taking a mind as strong as Akella's and filling its time mostly with political bullshit. Kronos believed in the hegemony's sacred purpose, and he was proud of his own genetics and ranking. But sometimes he wondered if his people didn't go off course sometimes. Killer Ontragus, and if this turns out to actually work, we're going to have to promote him, Kriegery or not, guessed that the enemy ships emitted a strange band of radiation, one that does not exist in normal space. Where does it exist, then? In the transit tubes, in the alternate space inside the pathways between systems. Akella was silent for a moment, but the shock was evident on her face. Hegemony science had come a significant part of the way back to the greatness of the old empire, but the tubes were still a complete mystery. No one even knew if the empire had created them long ago, during its vibrant initial period of growth, or if they had simply been found, the inheritance from some older, now lost civilization. But one thing was certain. Any civilization that could utilize, let alone master the technology of the tubes, was going to be enormously difficult to face in battle. If that's true. I know. Kronos looked down for a few seconds before his eyes returned to Akella. But whatever the implications for the enemy's technology, it is also a way to track them. At least we have reason to hope it is. Akella nodded, still clearly shaken by the revelation. What practicalities has the research produced? Do we have revised scanners ready for deployment? A pause and a deep sigh. I don't even know how we're going to make modifications to the entire fleet quickly enough, with the others advancing against us. Kronos looked down again. He knew how they were going to find that time, and he suspected Akella did too. By abandoning more worlds to the enemy, by pulling back, waiting to fight again until the fleet was ready. No matter how many billions that left at the enemy's mercy. We will have to find a way. We can't defend anyone if we can't target the enemy's ships. Kronos didn't push harder. He knew Akella understood the price the hegemony would pay for the time it needed, and he saw no reason to discuss it further. How far are you from something workable? That depends. They'd come to the part about which Kronos was deeply uncertain. He didn't like pushing off a momentous decision on Akella, of adding even more to her burden. But he was going to do it anyway. We have something we think will work right now, but it's completely untested. Ideally, I'd prefer to send a small task force to find the enemy and test the whole thing. Send a group of ships to almost certain destruction in the hopes that they are able to get back data via drone or courier ship hovering near the tube? Akella's description was grimmer than the one in Kronos' mind. It was also spot on. Yes, Kronos said reluctantly. But it would be extremely helpful to have solid operational data before we undertake a refit of the entire fleet, even at such a cost. You're right, it would, if we had the time, which we don't. Kronos was silent again. Akella was right, and he knew it. But he also knew they would be betting the survival of the hegemony on a wild guess that a single cruiser's commander had developed a way to target the enemy's ships. Without operational testing, without more data, the whole thing was insane. But as Kronos stood there, he knew it was their only choice.
and Akella obviously did too. Chapter 12. Grand Palai Hotel, Troia City, Megra Oleus 3, Year 322 AC.
You can't be serious.
Andy stood along the wall of the plush hotel suite, staring at Baron with an expression that mixed anger and fear, with just a touch of horror thrown in.
I knew this Admiral's wife thing was going to be difficult, but we've been married for what, 6 weeks? And you want to take off for hegemony space? And you don't want me to come?
Baron looked across the room. The exceedingly luxurious hotel was another structure that had been hastily rebuilt, probably as much to provide a place for senators to host their assignations and secret meetings as for the stated purpose of accommodating foreign dignitaries. Whatever the rationale, it made Baron uncomfortable, but there wasn't much choice in terms of lodgings. The Barons had long maintained a sizable manor house in Troia City, but that stately old building was now little more than shattered stone and twisted metal, and it hadn't even occurred to him to do something about that. He'd rebuild it, he was sure of that, but he would wait until the millions rendered homeless by the war had roofs over their heads. Andy, I don't want to go. Be reasonable. You can't play the role of some naive innocent. You understand strategy and tactics, and the dangers we face, pretty damned well, probably better than I do sometimes. You know the hegemony didn't surrender Colossus and end the war for no reason. Either they're up to something we don't know about, or there's one hell of a threat out there, one that is a total mystery to us. Either way, don't you think we have to know?
Of course we have to know, but why you? Why does it always have to be you?
I tried to explain that to you, but you already know. Why did you lead Pegasus into every dangerous corner of the Badlands? Why did you go after Ricard Lié? How about your trip to hegemony-occupied Danith? Neither one of us shies away from our duties, Andy. You know that.
But if the hegemony is planning something, you'll be putting yourself at their mercy.
Not exactly. I'll be taking a sizable task force with me.
Into the heart of the hegemony? And what good will that do if they turn on you? A few extra spacers to die with you?
There was something in Andy's tone. Something different. Baron had argued with her before. Legendary rows that seemed inevitable when two people of nearly infinite stubbornness were thrust together. But there was something there he hadn't heard before. Something new. Andy. Yes, it's possible the hegemony surrender of Colossus was some kind of trap. But you know that's not very likely. They could have beaten us in a straight-out fight if they'd continued, with or without Colossus. Baron hesitated. There's some kind of threat out there, I'm almost certain.
The hegemony isn't exactly our ally. Maybe their enemy is a potential friend.
That's certainly possible, but how can we know if we don't go out there and investigate?
So somebody has to go. I'll repeat my question. Why you?
Who else? Who can I send out there? Who can handle whatever happens, negotiate with the hegemony or their enemy, and make decisions on the spot? Who has that kind of authority?
No one.
Not you either. At least I'd bet the Senate doesn't think you do. That may be true, but I'm the closest we've got and you know that. I can get away with more than anyone else.
You mean you can mutiny if it serves your purpose, and have a decent chance of squirming out of trouble, and if that doesn't work, I can just come visit you in the stockade.
Baron didn't respond right away. There was something about the way Andy was arguing that was different from her normal controlled obstinance. And she's the last one who should be lecturing anyone about following the rules.
I'm sorry, Tyler.
Her voice softened, and she moved toward him, sliding her arms under his.
We've just had so many separations, so much time apart.
Baron had been on the verge of getting angry, of lashing back at her with all the time she'd insisted on doing something crazy, leaving him behind to worry. But her touch, and the soft sobbing he could hear as she pressed her face into his shoulder, drained his anger away. He was awash in guilt and regret, and he'd have declared his intention to remain on Megara with her then and there, if so much of his reason for going hadn't revolved around the fear of some deadly new enemy coming to the rim and killing millions. Killing Andy. He didn't say anything. He just put his arms around her and pulled her even closer. He didn't want to leave her any more than she wanted him to go. But he didn't have any choice. He had to defend the Confederation. He had to defend Andy.
I could go Coreward, you know, and you could stay here and deal with the defense of the Confederation.
Clint Winter stood no more than a meter from Baron, staring at his comrade with cold eyes.
Thank you, Clint. I appreciate that, but no. I've got senatorial authorization to investigate and to treat with the hegemony authorities, and my rank as Navy commander gives me more latitude to make spot decisions. Yeah, I can exceed my orders as well as you can. I think you know that. Baron was in no mood for laughter, but that didn't stop a small chuckle from forcing its way out. Yes, I do know that. Only too well, but I think it's got to be me for a number of reasons. I don't want to go, but I feel I have to, and that means you have to keep things under control here, and be ready for whatever happens if I don't. His voice slipped to silence. He didn't need to finish. He knew Winters understood. I'll watch the home fires, Ty. Winters still looked like he was on the verge of resuming his argument, but he remained silent. I know you will. And make sure Colossus is as well protected as possible until we're able to move her deeper into Confederation space. I authorized Anya Fritz to accelerate her efforts to get the thing mobile, which is a risk. But in Anya's hands, one I thought worth taking. I have to agree. If it was anyone else, I might think differently, but your old engineer from Dauntless is nothing short of a wizard in the guts of a ship. That she is. A pause, then. There's one other thing, Clint. I recorded a communique, and I'd like you to get it to Vi and Tullis on Palatia, without going through official channels. The Alliance's Imperator had returned to his homeworld just after the wedding, but Baron wanted his blood brother fully apprised. If some unknown enemy did threaten the Rim, he had no doubt Tullis would lead his forces into the fight without hesitation. But launching massive fleets for war took time and preparation, and Baron was going to see Tullis got just those very things. You mean without the Senate knowing about it? You know that's what I mean, old friend. Baron looked around, more an involuntary impulse than any real concern that he and Winters weren't alone. He wasn't looking to cause any trouble with the reconstituted Senate, but he didn't intend to risk them sending some watered-down communique to Tullis either. The Imperator would take Baron's word seriously, and that meant he'd have his forces ready if they were needed. And Baron's gut told him they would be needed. Consider it done. I'll get a thrill from slipping one by those chattering fools. Winters had, if possible, even less respect for politicians than Baron did. Thank you. And keep a close eye out. With the chunk of the fleet coming with me, a task force defending Colossus, and a ton of ships assisting the rebuilding efforts on and in orbit around Megara and Yulion, your free forces will be a little sparse. If anything unexpected happens, get word to Tullis. My communique asks him to take anything from you as if from my mouth. I'll keep watch, Ty, and I'll ask Tullis for help if I need it. Baron was silent for a moment, a grim look coming over his face. I do have one more favor to ask, Clint. A personal one. A brief silence. If something happens to me, will you look after Andy? Winters nodded gently. Of course, Ty, though I'm not sure I know anybody more capable of taking care of herself than Andy. Baron sighed softly. He hadn't been able to get Andy off his mind. He'd been prepared for a massive fight, a no-holds-barred battle to keep her on Megara, to prevent her from coming with him. He wanted her safe, and he'd been determined to hold his ground this time. But after the first few moments of argument, she hadn't even suggested coming. Of all the eventualities that had rattled around in his head, that one had never occurred to him. And it had unnerved him. Yes, that's true, but there's something different this time. She tried to get me to stay, but she didn't. Well, it was just different. It would really put my mind at ease if I knew you were keeping an eye on her. Say no more. I'd do whatever I could for you, Ty, and Andy's a friend, too. Whatever you run into out there, whatever scrapes you get into, you don't have to worry about her. Baron nodded appreciatively. It helped a lot to know Winters would be there, and he realized Andy could take care of herself. He didn't have to worry about her. But he was worried, so much that if anything less than the safety of the Rim was at stake, he wouldn't have gone. Andy stared out, gazing through the clear wall, her eyes moving in half a minute from moist to an outpouring of tears streaming down her face. She was worried about Baron, certainly, and sad about what promised to be a lengthy separation. They'd been torn apart so many times, and with the end of the war and their marriage, she'd finally let herself believe they'd have some time together. But there was more to it than that, a concern greater than separation. It was something she'd wrestled with telling him, and almost had. But in the end, she'd decided to keep it secret. She didn't want him distracted, worried about her. Especially not when he might very well be going into a life-and-death situation. She stood in the observation area, looking out through the gray fog and light rain toward the shuttle.
The doors had closed, almost indistinguishable from the gleaming white hull. She'd only caught a passing glimpse of him, and he hadn't even been aware she was there. She and Tyler had already said their goodbyes, again, at the hotel, but she decided to come to the spaceport and watch until his shuttle launched. The temporary facility was nothing compared to the vast complex destroyed during the fighting, and without internal launch hangars, Baron and his staff had been forced to walk across the wet tarmac to enter the shuttle. She'd watched as he stepped up the small ladder and climbed inside. She struggled to remain positive and optimistic, but her cold view of things compelled her to think what she'd tried so hard not to. Is that the last time I will see him? She remained where she was, unable to see Baron anymore, but willing to accept a view of the ship that carried him as an alternative to nothing. Her thoughts drifted back, across space and time, to the day she'd met then-Captain Tyler Baron. She remembered her first impression as though it had been yesterday. It had been far from love at first sight. In fact, he'd irritated the hell out of her. Pegasus and its tiny crew hadn't had any real chance to gain control over the planet killer and get it back to Confederation space. And if Dauntless hadn't intervened, she and all her people would almost certainly have been killed by the Sector 9 operatives also trying to seize the giant artifact. But at the time, those plainly obvious facts hadn't prevented her from blaming Dauntless's captain for keeping her from her prize, and for his ultimate destruction of the greatest treasure she had ever seen. That hadn't been her only impression, of course. As much as he drove her crazy, she couldn't lie to herself, not well enough to be convincing, at least. She had been attracted to him from the start, and as much as she despised naval officers and uniforms in those days, she had to admit he'd looked good in his. She watched as a cloud of steam enveloped the shuttle, the small craft's engines igniting and vaporizing, the water glistening on the hull and pooling all around. A few seconds later, she could see the blast, the flames pouring out from the thrusters as the shuttle moved, slowly at first, and then more rapidly into the sky. She watched the ship ascend for as long as she could see it in the gray, hazy morning, and then almost in an instant, it was gone. Tyler was gone. She stayed where she was for another moment. And then she heard a voice, her own, the words coming out almost involuntarily. She spoke softly, and what she said was meant only for herself. "You have to come back, Tyler, my love. You have to." She sniffled, a failed attempt to clear away her tears. "I need you. I've always needed you. We need you." She stared out at the blackened, empty stretch of the launch pad, still partially obscured by billowing clouds of white steam, the spot that had held Baron's shuttle until a moment before. "You have to come back, because I'm pregnant." Chapter 13 Hall of the People, Liberté City, Planet Mont-Morau, Gossara 4, Union Year 225, 321 AC.
"I want her found immediately. Is that understood?"
Gaston Villeneuve slammed his hand down hard on his desk, the pain resulting from the overly zealous move only adding to his fury.
"Do you know what I spend, what the Union government spends, on Sector 9, on police, on Feu de Rouge, on surveillance and computational assets, and none of you have been able to find one woman, a traitor on the run, who is to be hiding in some rat hole somewhere? Find her, or I'm going to start suspecting that some of you are in on the whole coup attempt."
The malevolence, the dark, sinister threat in that last sentence hung over the room.